From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we speak with geopolitical analyst Mark Sloboda about a number of issues around the world, beginning with what appears to be a minor incident in the Sea of Japan, but perhaps not. Mark, welcome.
Don, thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on CPR.
The pleasure and honor is all ours. So let's talk about first, is this some sort of a confrontation between South Korea and Japan, which is, I don't know, given the changing dynamics on the Korean Peninsula, maybe a foreshadowing of what kind of medium power plays might be taking place in the Asia of the future?
Yeah, it seems like a rather strange and seemingly unimportant incident, but there's a context behind it. So we're talking about the Dokdo Islands, also known as the Liancourt Rocks. Calling them islands is actually, making them up to be more than they are. There's 35 small rocks, right, lying in the Sea of Japan between South Korea and Japan, and they are claimed by both. So they've got disputed sovereignty claims over them between South Korea and Japan. The incident involved some Russian planes, including a reconnaissance plane and some other jets, that South Korea loudly proclaimed that Russian aircraft had violated its airspace and that it had fired some 300 warning shots, it says, on what it said were two incursions into their airspace. Russia doesn't take a position on the disputed sovereignty. It simply notes that the sovereignty over these islands is questioned. Second of all, Russia says that it did not actually come closer than 25 miles to these islands, and that it did not even, whoever owns these islands, it did not violate them. If you look a little bit closer past the headlines, you will find that Korea's claim is not actually that Russia violated its airspace, but that it violated its airspace identification zone.
Right.
Now, these identification zones are something that the U.S. started. Basically, they are a self-declared extension, unrecognized by international law, of national airspace out to nearly double its extent, saying that any aircraft that enter this area have to declare themselves and conduct themselves under the country in question.
Yeah, the theory behind this is there's a declaration, okay, this is our legal zone, this is the equipment that we're using to patrol it, the technical requirements of the equipment require that we have this much information this far out and that much that far out. Therefore, in order to respect our zone legally here, you have to provide us with this information there.
Yes, in international airspace.
Right.
Okay. Russia doesn't recognize these identification zones. Right. They were something started to be declared years ago by the United States, and now many of its allies, including obviously South Korea, have declared their own identification zones.
Right.
Now Russia has flown to these islands, in the same proximity before, and there hasn't been this big incident. And it should be noted that Japan, which also claims sovereignty, disputes South Korea's claim over these rocks, did not make a big deal about this at all. And to make it even more curious, South Korea and Russia actually have excellent relations. Of course, both South Korea and Japan do both host U.S. military bases, multiple of them, right? And the Russia isn't exactly happy about that. But for normal international relations, economic relations, South Korea and Russia normally have excellent relations. But there's something else about this incident, because it wasn't just Russian planes. This was Russian and Chinese planes.
Right. That's right. Yep.
And it wasn't just a military exercise. We all know Russia and China have done lots of military exercises in recent years, increasing tempo and size and coordination and everything. This was actually the first declared joint regular Russian-Chinese joint aircraft security patrols in the Pacific.
Right.
And this is what this big outcry and response of this was actually about.
Right.
And it's kind of shocking the U.S. and its allies in the Pacific, because this shows that Russian and Chinese military, strategic partnership is actually moving towards alliance.
Right.
And this is really shocking and scaring people. For the last 15 years, all the way up till now, you've got a whole bunch of Western geopolitical commentators who are all like, oh, yeah, they may be friendly right now, but inevitably Russia and China are going to turn on each other, and China is going to take over Siberia, and Russia will be little brother to the Chinese giant, and they'd be better off if they just became a servant of the United States. You know, all of this none of this, of course, has come into reality. China is a country that Russia believes it can do business with, and vice versa. And they've completely demilitarized their borders and drawn ever closer politically, economically, militarily, culturally, you name it. And this expected split between Russia and China, that Western geopoliticians have been, basically wishful thinking for nearly two decades now, has gone nowhere. In fact, the exact opposite. Everything the U.S. does, pushing both countries militarily, doing naval and air parades off their coasts, so on and so on, plus its aggressions throughout the Middle East with Iran and so on, has just pushed the two countries closer and closer and closer together. And this is just another sign of it. So it is kind of a big deal.
It's amazing, actually. The U.S., on the one hand, first of all, yes, it's a Pacific power. You have Hawaii, the west coast of the United States, and Alaska. I guess the Aleutian Islands are the furthest point west. Asia is China, Russia, Korea, Japan. That's, this is kind of like the heart of Asia, the Pacific Asia anyway.
Even Russia, I would say, is kind of a fringe player.
Yes and no. They have an awful lot of coastline directly in the neighborhood, though.
Yeah, but it's also Russia's least developed region.
Right, of course. That's right. It's understood. Right. But there, legally, there's no distinction in terms of jurisdiction if you have two people living there or 2 billion. These are your boundaries. This is what you have offshore. These are your rights to patrol it, et cetera, et cetera. And so, they are putting power there. It may be physically power projection for Russia because the bulk of the industrial economy is much further west. But practically speaking, it's not projection. It's right there. We're present. For the United States, it's projection, unless you want to count the Aleutian Islands as the center of the American economy.
Yeah. What I find really interesting is that everyone has declared this, the 21st century to be the Pacific century, right? And both United States and Russia have talked a lot of game about an Asian pivot. But there's a big distinction in what that Asian pivot means. Mm. For the United States, it means the military containment right. of China,
right.
which they see as a military, economic, political threat to their hegemony.
Right.
And their Asian pivot is trying to move as many naval, air, and military assets
right.
Into the Pacific as right. close to China as possible, and building up an alliance of countries stretching from Australia to India to Japan and South Korea to try to corral and coerce them into confronting China along
and
with
Peru them. And whatever else they can muster.
Right. Yeah, whatever else they can muster. Russia's Asian pivot, on the other hand, sees China's rise as an opportunity. First of all, you know, there's the whole political and military cooperation between the two countries, you know, in the Pacific region. Russia is on top of these new air patrols. Russia has already been doing joint naval patrols with right. China, including right. in the South China Sea,
right.
Which again is a big deal. And even more than that, Russia sees the rise of China and the other Asian powers, you know, it's not just about China, of course, as economic opportunity, right? And it is trying to develop this far east of Russia, right? And get into the game. You know, Russia has long right. put, you know, for centuries, has put most of its investment in the West towards Europe.
Right.
Well,
right.
now capital flows all over the world are going to Asia instead. Russia suddenly remembers that it is also a Pacific country.
We have some of that. Yeah, right.
And they are doing everything they can to get investment and develop trade in the Pacific as well as that. And of course, Russia's, you know, if you want to talk about them as an energy superpower status,
right.
providing gas, oil, and you know, of course, other metals and other resources, not just to China, but potentially Japan, South Korea. And that actually gives them a lot more game, a lot more potential
for sure.
in that area. Than might otherwise be assumed.
And they have no Strait of Hormuz to pass through to deliver energy
no.
to China, Japan,
oh,
or Korea either.
Even more than that, the Arctic Sea Route, the Northern Sea Route,
right.
is opening now, particularly for the summers. Trade along it is starting to become regular.
I didn't want to go there because I was about to jump there from the last sentence. I didn't want to go there to take this off track, but since you are going there, you know, people talking about a pivot to Asia, as a matter of fact, you know, if there's any weight whatsoever in this whole, you know, climate change theory, certainly the way people are looking at things around the Arctic, it may well be on its way to becoming the Mediterranean, literally, in terms of being
yeah, well,
the middle of the Earth, but where the center of development of the world over the next century or two.
Believe me, there is no country in the world that sees the reality of anthropogenic climate change more than Russia,
right?
Because it is the northern latitudes that see the greatest temperature variation,
right? Right.
And a whole lot of Russia's territory is in the Arctic.
Right.
We see the permafrost melting like
right.
it never has done before.
Right.
And this causes infrastructure damage to a lot. Remember, Russia has more cities in the Arctic,
that's right.
Partly because of Soviet forcible movement of peoples, right? A lot more than Canada does. Canada's population is squeezed along the U.S. border for the most part. Russia has the most significant cities there. They see lots of infrastructure damage to pipelines. They see these methane bubbles, right, bursting on the Siberian steppe, right, where permafrost is melting and methane bubbles out and creates giant explosions and craters, but also these huge methane bubble releases in the ocean, which
right.
Should scare everyone because
yeah, right.
methane gas is 21 times more potent than carbon dioxide
right.
as a greenhouse gas.
That's right.
Russia sees the reality there. Russia has had to give up. Russia has is probably the most Arctic developed country. Not only do they have a larger number of icebreakers than any other country, they have nuclear-powered icebreakers. They have floating portable nuclear power stations to provide power in the Arctic to research and military stations and so on. And Russia has, for the first time, had to abandon all of its quite numerable Arctic research stations on the sea ice in the Arctic. Remember, the Arctic, unlike Antarctica, is frozen ocean. There's no land under there on, right, on the northern part of it. Right. They've had to abandon all the research stations in the Arctic this summer because, right, there's not enough stable ice to support
them. Right, right. It's melting. You know, yeah, Russia has a population of 145 to 150 million people. And if you, Canada's is under 40 million, and Scandinavia, including Denmark, it is around 25, maybe, million. You got 10, 15, 20, yeah, about 25 million. So the population of Russia is between 2 and 3 times that of the other, countries in the Arctic Circle, within the Arctic Circle. So it's a huge chunk of the population that's in that, yeah, already. And also, you know, the domestic capital base, I guess, is larger also, because, you know, as a consequence of the population.
Yeah, anyway, so the Arctic race, I guess, we'll leave for another time. Let's shift to another incident this week in the Middle East that is all about Iran. And this is that the U.S., for the first time since 2003, the U.S. military is returning to Saudi Arabia.
Uh-oh.
They've been out of there since the Iraq War,
right,
and they're back with, of course, the permission of the Saudi regime.
Right.
And they've already sent some 500 troops. These 500 troops are almost all engineers and logistics people, and what they are doing is prepping and expanding Prince Sultan Air Base. This is just, you know, a vanguard force. It is going to be expanded much more. They're already moving in stealth fighters and Patriot Air Defense. And this is going to be significant. And the
this
reason,
is the material
of course,
wherewithal.
Is about the tensions in,
right. This is the material
the
wherewithal. Right. Yeah.
Iran.
Right. This is the material wherewithal of a war with Iran.
Yeah. And right. The reason why they need this air base is because they are denied the use of a lot of other countries that they usually use for power projection in the Gulf because they're building towards a conflict with Iran. Foremost among those is Iraq, right? The U.S. has a lot of military assets in Iraq, military bases, but Iraq's constitution forbids foreign powers that are allowed on its territory using their assets or its bases against neighboring powers. And if the Iraqi government was pressured or decided to go along with it and break their own constitution, they'd be facing civil war because Iraq is a Shia majority country.
Right.
And its population looks rather favorably towards Iran. Right. Particularly more favorably than they do towards the United States anyway. Right. So Iraq is off the table. But whatever the U.S. does, if the U.S. engages in conflict in Iran, U.S. military assets in Iraq become targets, right? And there's no question that there will be, you know, we call it a guerrilla war or so on. But right. Shia militias in Iraq will almost certainly, whether directed by Iran or of their own accord, attack U.S. military assets in Iraq. But they can't use their air bases. Second of all, Turkey. And this is one because Turkey actually has good economic, at least, relations with Iran, although they're, of course, they're on opposite sides of the conflict in Syria. And the United States right now is going through a very sore spot in relations with Turkey because of Turkish accusations about U.S. involvement or at least negligence during the coup attempt against Erdogan several years ago, the U.S. support of the Kurds in Syria. The U.S. Kicking Turkey out of the F-35 program and possibly sanctioning them over Turkey's acquisition of the Russian S-400 air defense system. Mm. So Turkish-U.S. relations are really at a sore spot right now, and there's really no question that Turkey won't allow the U.S. to use its air bases for an attack in Iran. Mm. And even U.S. air bases in Qatar are questionable. CENTCOM. That's the home of CENTCOM, a huge U.S. Air Force base normally in Qatar for control of the Middle East. But Qatar also has fairly decent relations with Iran, probably the best relations of any Arab country with Iran. And we have this whole Saudi-Qatari split that's still been simmering for quite some time.
Yep.
So there's no guarantee that even Qatar would allow the U.S. to use its bases and assets for a conflict with Iran. That's why opening this military base in Saudi Arabia for conflict with Iran is so important. And you're going to see the troops and the gear and the air assets, the drones, expand and expand and expand at that air base.
You know, let me ask you, I think everybody's got a nightmare scenario where they see the next move in the Middle East, you know, lighting a match that has the whole thing go up in smoke. But my particular scenario has some question marks on the map. Say Bahrain, for example. Now, you had what was a peaceful uprising in Bahrain against the king back, I don't know, now.
A Shia majority ruled over
by
a Sunni monarchy.
Right, okay.
Backed by the Saudi government.
And a country that's a host to the largest naval U.S. naval base in the region, right?
I mean,
the country itself is a naval base, more or less, with like a little bit of country appended to it. And so... You know, lighting that match, for example, could conceive. You know, it's the government's stayed in power because of the Saudis occupied the country, basically at the invitation of the king and the United States. They certainly are not loved by the Shia population there. And if that match got lit, it's conceivable that the people there could be an uprising and perhaps not quite so peaceful this time. And
absolutely,
and this is right on the underbelly of the naval presence there.
Even more, all right, Lebanon. Right, Jordan, Palestine.
Yeah, Palestine's walking off the table now. Yep.
Saudi Arabia itself has a Shia minority in the south, along the Yemeni's border, at a place where their biggest oil wells are located. And it's not well reported, but part of the reason why Saudi Arabia buys so much military equipment all the time from the U.S. and France and Germany and the United Kingdom and so on, is that they are constantly fighting a low-intensity war against their own Shia minority in Saudi Arabia, and they're continually losing assets there. And that's actually what the invasion of Yemen is all about.
Right.
It's about the demonstration effect and the fact that tribes in the desert there don't really care about declarations of a state border between Saudi Arabia and Yemen, where they've lived in their way of life has been minimally changed for rather long periods of time.
Right.
And of course, Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, and Iran and Afghanistan, of course, where there's also military assets on Iran's other border. The whole region goes up in flames. Everything goes up in flames. And it's because the U.S. has definitively taken sides on the Sunni-Shia conflict in the Middle East, which is expressed as mostly between Saudi Arabia and Iran.
All right, so, I've been saying since Trump started walking into the office in Washington that you had to pay attention to the fact that there was a cartoon narrative that was being bandied about in the media, both by the media and then by Trump administration in reply to the media and in reply to the Democrats. And then there's the reality of things. And so, you know, when you talk about, for example, starting to tune up the military infrastructure by, you know, sending engineers to a base in Saudi Arabia that's going to be used to, you know, base hostile actions against Iran from, etc., that's real. And then you've got the cartoon show that Bolton, you know, wants to nuke Tehran, and Trump wants to have dinner with Rouhani, you know, and everything in between is sort of the cartoon show. I'm trying to
the
divine. Yeah, exactly. You know, there is a word that Trump used referring to poor and disorganized countries to talk about them, and that you could use here ahead of the word show. That is sort of what they peddle in, as a narrative. There's the blank show and then the reality of it. Looking at the reality of it, you know, there's a preparation for, you know, for war, certainly. Do you think that this is the result of a fracture in the government in Washington, that, you know, some people are moving the assets in there in order to force an incident that'll force a war? Or is it something else?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's a division in the Trump administration, even if it's only between Trump on odd days and Trump on even days, whether he disagrees too, right? Or agrees with Bolton. I don't have any reliance on Trump, right? Either because of his mercurial nature, right, or because he really is pressured by the neocons and the interventionists on the other side of the aisle. But it doesn't really make any difference for us in the rest of the world, because it still comes out to be the same thing.
Right.
And I've got another, we're talking about all these sparks that are, you know, potentially building up in the Gulf there for conflict. I've got another one for you. You know that there's already been conflicts between the U.S. and Iranian navies, and that the U.S., yeah, in fact, U.S. politicians have called to sink the Iranian Navy.
Yeah,
and the U.S. is continuing to move more naval assets, you know, into the Gulf as it's moving air assets into Prince Sultan Air Base.
Just pour gasoline on it,
the
right?
Region,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So the British government announced that it's sending naval assets into the Gulf. And then in the same week, it announced that it's sending even more naval assets into the Gulf. The U.S. is also trying to corral the Arab countries around Saudi Arabia into building their own patrol force for the Gulf, you know, the UAE, Bahrain, and others. Although they've been kind of dragging their feet on this, because although, you know, they do have naval assets that they've all bought from Western European countries,
right,
a lot of them are tied up in the starvation blockade of Yemen right now, which hasn't been going all that well for them. In fact, the UAE recently announced that we'll see how much of it actually happens, but they're pulling out of Yemen, abandoning the Saudi effort, which tells you how well it's going there, even with all those advanced U.S. arms and mercenaries from around the world and everything against the poorest country in the world. And, you know, Saudi Arabia is not such great fighters, despite all of this, you know, spending on military equipment from Western powers. That's why they're kind of dragging their feet, as are the other Arab states. They don't want to get involved in a naval conflict with Iran in the Gulf. They want the U.S. to get involved,
exactly,
in a naval conflict with Iran. They,
exactly,
want the U.S. Navy boys and girls to do the dying for them. They don't want to get involved.
Right.
But we've got another player now.
We got to do this in about 30 seconds, because we're pretty much out of time. And want to maybe pick
China,
it up?
Oh. Yeah, China just announced that they are approving of Russia's proposal to them to send joint naval forces to patrol the Persian Gulf.
Okay, so we're going to pick it up there next week, and hopefully we'll still be around. It won't have happened and produced an incident between now and then. Mark, thank you very much for your time and your insight, as always.
Thanks for having me.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.